A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what freedom of the press means in its purest form, and what some of the subtle ways are that it gets undermined. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. But what if the most effective censorship doesn't come from Congress at all?
That's the tension, right? The text is absolute. The lived reality is anything but. And what's fascinating is that the purest definition of press freedom is actually quite narrow. It's the absence of prior restraint. No government body gets to approve what you publish before you publish it. No licensing scheme for journalists. No pre-publication review board. That second question is where the real action is, because the obvious attacks are easy to spot. It's the quiet ones that hollow the whole thing out.
A government raid on a newsroom makes headlines. A terms of service update does not. So let's start with the pure form. What are we actually protecting when we protect press freedom?
The cleanest definition comes from William Blackstone in 1769. He said, press freedom is laying no previous restraints upon publications. That's it, no prior restraint. You don't need a license to publish, and the government can't stop you before you go to print. After publication, if what you wrote is illegal, libel, incitement, classified material, you can face consequences. And I want to be precise about this. The purest form of press freedom means three things simultaneously. First, no prior restraint. The government cannot stop you from publishing.
Which is a radically different model from, say, a broadcast license. The government doesn't hand you a permission slip.
And third, some structural protection for the news-gathering process itself. Shield laws for sources, protection from retaliatory pressure. The state of Minnesota tried to shut down a newspaper called the Saturday Press. It was this scandal sheet accusing local officials of corruption, some of it anti-Semitic, genuinely unpleasant stuff. But the Supreme Court said no, you can't enjoin a publication from publishing. Chief Justice Hughes wrote that prior restraint is the essence of censorship. The remedy for bad speech is more speech, not a judicial gag order.
Here's what I find interesting about Neer. The court didn't say prior restraint is never permissible. They left a crack in the door for things like troop movements in wartime or obscenity. How do we think about that tension? If the principle isn't absolute, doesn't that create the very vulnerability we're talking about?
It does, and that's why the Pentagon Papers case in 1971 is so important as the bookend to Neer. The Nixon administration tried to enjoin the New York Times and the Washington Post from publishing the Pentagon Papers, arguing national security. Strategic lawsuits against public participation. And this is a mechanism that's almost elegant in its cynicism. Here's how it works. A powerful entity, corporation, developer, wealthy individual files a defamation suit against a journalist or small outlet. The suit has almost no chance of winning on the merits. But that's not the point. That's an almost impossibly high bar, and it was designed to be.
The doctrine evolved from no prior restraint to prior restraint only if the sky is actively falling. That's a much stronger shield.
For a small local paper, that's existential. You might have done absolutely nothing wrong. Your reporting might be bulletproof, but you still have to pay six figures to prove it.
That's before we talk about the time cost. You mentioned the Highland County Press case from Ohio in 2023. What happened there?
Local paper in a small Ohio county. They reported on a developer's project, standard local government accountability stuff. The developer filed a defamation suit. The paper spent 18 months fighting it. 18 months of legal fees, depositions, document production. The suit was eventually dismissed. The paper won. But during those 18 months, they lost two reporters because the budget couldn't sustain both the legal defense and the newsroom salaries. You don't see a bakery clause or a shipbuilding clause. The press got special constitutional status because the framers understood that self-government doesn't work if the governed can't find out what the government is doing.
That structural role is what makes press freedom different from anyone can have a blog. The press has a function. It's supposed to be the adversarial check. Which is why, when people say the media is the enemy of the people, they're missing the point in a very specific way. The press is supposed to be adversarial. That's the job description.
The adversarial posture isn't a bug, and you can trace this understanding back to the founding era. Jefferson had that famous line about preferring newspapers without government to government without newspapers. Let's say you're the editor of a paper with a newsroom of 6 people and an annual legal budget of essentially zero. A reporter brings you a story about a local developer who's been funneling campaign contributions to city council members who then approved a zoning variance. The story is solid. Documents, sources, everything checks out. But you know this developer.
In its purest form, press freedom means no one needs permission to publish, and no one gets punished after the fact for content that isn't illegal. The state doesn't get a veto. That's the Platonic ideal. Now, let's talk about all the ways that ideal gets carved up without anyone passing a censorship law.
Can you risk a reporter's salary on the chance that this guy sues again? And that's the chill. You haven't been censored. No one told you not to publish. But the math is the censor.
There's been some movement on anti-slap reform, though, right?
Yes. 18 states passed some form of anti-slap reform in 2024 and 2025. The idea is to create a mechanism for early dismissal of meritless suits, often with fee shifting so the plaintiff pays the defendant's legal costs. But here's the problem. Federal anti-slap legislation, the SPEAK Free Act, remains stalled as of March 2026, so you've got a patchwork. Strong protections in some states, virtually none in others.
Which means if you're a publication with a national readership, you have to worry about being sued in the least protective jurisdiction, where your story is accessible.
Which leads us to the related problem of libel tourism. And this is where things get genuinely Kafkaesque. The United Kingdom has plaintiff-friendly libel laws. The burden of proof is essentially reversed compared to the EU. The defendant has to prove the truth of the statement, rather than the plaintiff having to prove falsity. The costs can exceed £1 million. So what happens is, wealthy international figures sue in London even when the publication and the allegedly defamed subject have minimal UK connections. You start self-censoring before the threat letter even arrives.
Like adopting a feral cat. The damage isn't the cat, it's that you stop opening your windows.
The billionaire's London law firm sent a letter threatening a libel suit. The blog removed the article. Not because they believed they would lose on the merits, because even winning would cost them more than the publication could bear. The contractor filed a defamation suit. 18 months of discovery, motions, and legal fees later, the plaintiff dropped the case voluntarily. No judgment against the journalist. Complete vindication on paper. But the outlet folded. That's the libel tourism problem in a nutshell. And the SPEAK Free Act, if it ever passes, includes provisions to make foreign libel judgments unenforceable in EU courts if they don't meet First Amendment standards, but again, stalled.
What happened to them?
They paid their own legal fees, which for a well-capitalized business is just a cost of doing business. The asymmetry is the whole point. The plaintiff spends $50,000 to impose $500,000 of costs on the defendant. These letters typically come with a deadline.
What about anti-slap statutes? Don't most states have them? I thought the whole point was to allow early dismissal and fee shifting, so the plaintiff has to pay the defendant's legal costs.
Most small outlets don't have foreign litigation insurance at all, so the decision gets made under conditions of radical uncertainty. And when the downside is potentially existential, £1 million judgment against a publication with annual revenue of maybe $300,000, the rational choice is to take the article down. Not because you were wrong, because you can't afford to be right. The deterrent effect kicks in long before the remedy does.
The anti-slap laws are like having a fire extinguisher that you can only afford to use after the kitchen is already on fire.
What's happening is more subtle and in some ways more powerful, precisely because it operates outside any framework of accountability.
Walk me through the mechanics. It says nothing about what a private company can do with its terms of service.
They're optimizing for engagement, and there's a fundamental tension between what's engaging and what's informative. The distribution infrastructure for journalism in 2026 is almost entirely privately owned. Substack, YouTube, X, TikTok, these are not common carriers. They're private companies with terms of service that can change at any moment.
A change to those terms is functionally a change to publishing law, except there's no legislature, no public comment period, no due process.
But the practical effect, according to the Reuters Institute's 2025 digital news report, was that 47% of news publishers saw a 30% or greater drop in referral traffic from platforms in the 12 months prior. YouTube updated its content suitability standards to restrict monetization on content that depicts armed conflict without clear editorial contextualization. The stated goal was brand safety. Announced in April 2026 that it was further reducing news distribution across its platforms. Again, not a government action. Just a business decision by a private company that happens to control a massive share of the information distribution infrastructure.
There was that controversy during the Australian bushfire season in 2025. What happened there? That is editorial contextualization. But YouTube's system isn't evaluating the narration. It's looking for production markers it was trained to recognize, branded intro sequences, the things a field correspondent literally cannot provide.
But Google's algorithm update at the time prioritized what it called authoritative sources, which it defined as major wire services and government agencies. So, independent climate reporting got buried in search results during a literal crisis, while generic wire copy from Reuters and AP surfaced at the top.
That's not a human making a decision to suppress climate journalism. That's an algorithmic preference for institutional authority over on-the-ground expertise.
That distinction matters tremendously for how we think about press freedom. If a government official told Google to bury independent climate coverage, that would be a clear First Amendment violation, state action. But when the algorithm does the same thing as a byproduct of an update designed to fight SEO spam, there's no legal remedy, no one to sue, no one to hold accountable. Substack's position was that the embedded material violated their policy on content from sanctioned entities. The publication's position was that embedding a primary source document for reporting purposes is standard journalistic practice. That's the phrase. And what makes this a press freedom issue, even though it's not a legal violation, is that the practical effect is identical to censorship. Stories that are reported, fact-checked, and published never reach their audience.
The terms of service is law problem. A platform's content policy has more immediate impact on what gets published than the First Amendment does.
Because the First Amendment prevents the government from stopping you. It doesn't prevent Substack from stopping you. And if Substack is where your audience is, that distinction is academic.
If journalists want to reach audiences, build your own distribution channels. What's wrong with that argument? If we force platforms to carry everything, aren't we violating their editorial discretion?
Controls the social feed for billions of users. You can build the best website in the world, but if neither platform surfaces your content, you're essentially invisible. The market for attention is not a free market. It's a market with two enormous gatekeepers who control the on-ramps. The legal scholar Genevieve Lockyer at the University of Chicago has argued that the common carrier framework has deep roots in American law, going back to the 19th century, and that it might apply to dominant digital platforms without violating their First Amendment rights. They're not in the news business. They're in the attention business.
We're in this weird limbo where the platforms have more power over the practical exercise of press freedom than any government entity, but the legal framework for constraining that power doesn't exist yet.
Not because anyone at Google dislikes journalism, because the math says journalism underperforms on the metrics that drive revenue.
We've got legal chilling through slap suits and libel tourism. We've got algorithmic suppression through engagement optimized ranking. What's the third mechanism?
And I realize this sounds less dramatic than lawsuits and shadow banning, but stay with me because the structural implications are arguably more profound. In practice, the Department of Justice Inspector General's 2025 report found that the average response time for complex FOIA requests hit 34 months. That's nearly 3 years. Let me give you the numbers. Neiman Lab published data in January 2026 showing that the average annual cost for a bundle of 5 major news subscriptions is now $487.
They charge you for the privilege of waiting.
Search fees, review fees, duplication fees, agencies can and do bill requesters thousands of dollars. There are documented cases where an agency quoted a fee that was clearly designed to make the requester withdraw the request. About 40%. And that's not including local papers, which increasingly have their own paywalls. So what you get is a two-tier information ecosystem. People who can afford $487 a year get access to independent, professionally reported journalism.
It's the bureaucratic equivalent of saying, sure, you can look at the documents as soon as you climb this greased pole. Technically, access exists. Practically, it doesn't.
The real artistry is in the classification system. Documents get stamped, operational, or deliberative under exemptions that are supposed to be narrow, but in practice are used as catch-all reasons to withhold. Before anyone says this is just how markets work, I understand the business argument. Journalism costs money to produce. Ad-supported models collapsed because Google and captured the ad market.
You've got a statutory right to information that's enforced by asking nicely and hoping the agency doesn't decide to bury you in fees and delays.
This isn't a bug. It's a feature designed by agencies that understand exactly how to neutralize transparency obligations without formally opposing them. This creates a feedback loop that's worth examining. If your audience is disproportionately affluent and educated, your editorial priorities shift. Not through any conspiracy, just through market incentives.
There's a wonderful term for this in the FOIA community, administrative blackout. The documents exist, they're technically accessible, but the process of accessing them is so Byzantine that the information might as well be classified. Can we make this concrete? Give me an example of a story that gets covered less because of this dynamic.
Take rural hospital closures. Between 2020 and 2025, more than 100 rural hospitals in the United States closed their doors. This is a massive public health story. It affects millions of people. It involves complex questions of Medicare reimbursement policy, private equity acquisition of healthcare facilities, state-level decisions about Medicaid expansion.
A well-funded newsroom can absorb a slap suit, wait out a FOIA delay, and build direct distribution channels. An underfunded newsroom can't do any of those things. So the economic question isn't separate from the press freedom question. It's the foundation.
Pew Research has tracked local newspaper ad revenue declining 60% since 2010. That's not a dip, that's a collapse. When I first saw that number, I had to check it 3 times, and the money didn't go to other news organizations. Which brings us to the fourth mechanism, and I think this one is the most insidious because it's entirely internal, not the dramatic kind where a government censor redacts paragraphs. The quiet kind where an editor kills a story before it's even pitched because they've internalized all the constraints we just discussed.
Preemptive editorial narrowing. It wasn't an inevitable technological shift. It was a market structure choice.
In 4 years, the number jumped 21 points. The community loses its watchdog, and nobody replaces it.
The feedback loop is vicious. Fewer journalists means less accountability reporting. Less accountability means more corruption. More corruption means less public trust in institutions, including the media. The most common reason journalists hold back is that they're afraid of being mobbed on social media.
This isn't abstract. There was a freelance journalist in Texas in 2024 who stopped covering school board meetings after receiving death threats and having their home address published online. The police declined to investigate, citing free speech protections for the harassers.
The industrial production of news-like content that fills space but doesn't hold power to account.
This isn't censorship in any legal sense. Nobody is stopping anyone from publishing. The harassment is private action, not state action. The police declining to investigate is arguably state inaction, not state suppression. But the practical outcome is that a journalist stops covering a public institution because the personal cost is too high. The school board meetings go uncovered. The public loses oversight. And none of this triggers any First Amendment scrutiny.
I want to connect this back to something you said earlier about the Highland County Press case, because there's a pattern here. In both cases, the mechanism works because the cost of being right is higher than the cost of staying quiet. Whether it's legal fees or death threats, the journalist who does their job correctly still pays a price.
That's a grimly perfect analogy, and the wire services become the backbone of local news by default. That's the asymmetry. The developer who files a meritless slap suit risks nothing if they lose. The online harasser who posts a journalist's home address faces no consequences. But the journalist risks everything, their savings, their safety, their career. And when the risk-reward calculus is that lopsided, the rational choice, over time, is to avoid the risk, which means avoiding the story.
Where most corruption actually happens, incidentally. The stuff that affects people's daily lives.
The big national stories get covered. The local contracting irregularities, the quiet abuse of eminent domain, the cozy relationship between a developer and a planning board, that's what disappears when local newsrooms empty out.
Let's be specific about what that looks like on the ground. There's a study from the University of Illinois that looked at municipal bond yields in communities that lost their local newspaper. Bond yields went up because without a local watchdog, investors perceived higher corruption risk and demanded higher returns. The loss of press freedom literally made it more expensive for the community to borrow money. This isn't abstract. 1.3 reporters for 50,000 people.
That's not a newsroom. That's a gesture toward having a newsroom. When you have 1.3 reporters, you can't cover city council meetings. You can't investigate the county budget. You can't do enterprise reporting on the school system.
All right. The third knock-on effect is the one that I think is most philosophically troubling. Algorithmic prior restraint.
This is where the conceptual framework from Near versus Minnesota collides with 21st century reality. Prior restraint is when the government stops you from publishing before you publish. That's unconstitutional. That's the phrase I'd use. No one told those papers not to cover City Hall. They just made it structurally impossible to do so. And the First Amendment has absolutely nothing to say about it because the government isn't involved.
You call it a business decision, apparently.
The March 2026 internal TikTok memo leaked to The Intercept is the smoking gun here. The memo detailed automated suppression of content related to Palestinian reporting based on community guidelines that were never publicly disclosed. That's the defense Alden would offer. But there's evidence that the extraction model accelerates the death spiral rather than preventing it.
Functionally equivalent to prior restraint, executed by a machine learning model instead of a judge, with no appeal mechanism and no public record of the decision.
The distinction between removal and suppression is legally significant, but practically meaningless. If you publish something and nobody sees it, have you really published? From a First Amendment standpoint, the government didn't stop you. The appeal was a nonprofit criminal justice outlet, won major awards, did impactful investigative work on prosecutorial misconduct, prison conditions, sentencing disparities, shut down in 2025, not because their journalism was bad.
There's a philosophical question here that I keep coming back to. The First Amendment assumes a certain model of communication, a speaker, a message, and an audience that can choose to listen or not. But algorithmic filtering breaks that model. Where did the money go?
Donors shifted priorities to AI and climate, which are important topics. But the structural problem is that journalism that holds the criminal justice system accountable is now dependent on the philanthropic preferences of a handful of foundations. When those preferences shift, the journalism disappears. That's not a free press. That's a press on a patronage model. And the curator isn't covered by the First Amendment's restrictions.
Which nobody in Congress seems particularly eager to address.
You can't cover what you don't have reporters to cover. As of May 2026, it's stalled in committee. Hasn't even gotten a markup.
Economic barriers through paywalls and hedge fund consolidation. And self-censorship, through fear of harassment and retaliation.
What connects all four is that none of them involve a government official saying you cannot publish this. The First Amendment is intact. The legal right is secure. But the practical capacity to exercise that right is eroding across multiple fronts simultaneously. The new model is negotiate access, then publish. You have to treat platform terms of service as a binding constraint, build legal defense funds into your operating budget, and maintain relationships with platform policy teams. The better question is what you alluded to earlier, free for whom, to do what, under what constraints.
The closure of the Altamont Enterprise in New York is the story that crystallizes all of this. 150-year-old paper, been publishing since the 1870s. The danger of focusing only on the legal definition is that you can point to the intact First Amendment and say everything's fine, while the actual infrastructure of journalism crumbles.
This is what I find frustrating about a lot of press freedom discourse. It's focused on the most dramatic threats. Journalists arrested, newspapers shut down by decree, explicit state censorship. Those things happen and they matter. But in the United States in 2026, the more pervasive threats are quieter. no one's getting arrested.
The plaintiff in that case didn't break any laws. They used the legal system exactly as designed. The problem is that the design creates an asymmetry that punishes the party with fewer resources, regardless of the merits.
Which brings us to the unifying theme here. These aren't separate problems, they're a system. The slap mechanism deters investigative reporting. The economic collapse of local advertising starves newsrooms. One thing I'd recommend is what I'd call a chill audit. Go back through the last year of editorial decisions. Map every story you didn't pursue. Categorize the reason. Was it legal fear? Source access concern? Platform dependency worry? Most newsrooms have never done this systematically because the decisions not to pursue stories are invisible by nature. You can't see what wasn't published.
The pattern would be revealing. A journalist whose work gets algorithmically suppressed can't report on algorithmic suppression because, well, because the story gets suppressed. The system is designed to be invisible from the inside.
They're economic and social, and most people don't step back. They just notice that their local paper got thinner, or that a story they expected to see never appeared, and they move on.
We've mapped the erosion. The question is, what do we do about it? Let's get practical.
The Local Journalism Sustainability Act was reintroduced in February 2026 with bipartisan co-sponsors. That's the kind of thing that could actually move the needle, public funding for local news that's structurally insulated from political interference. Platform regulation that requires algorithmic transparency. Right now, when Google or changes their algorithm and news referral traffic drops 30%, publishers have no recourse. They can't even get a clear explanation of what changed.
If you're a journalist, building a legal defense line into your budget isn't optional anymore. It's as essential as paying for hosting.
Recognize that press freedom isn't binary. The question isn't, is the press free? It's free for whom, to do what, under what constraints? That reframing matters because it allows for targeted intervention rather than vague outrage. If the constraint is legal, the solution is legal reform. If the constraint is economic, the solution is funding models. If the constraint is algorithmic, the solution is platform accountability. The technical term is reducing single points of failure, and it's basic engineering applied to publishing infrastructure.
RSS is the cockroach of internet protocols. Unglamorous, indestructible, and surprisingly hard to kill.
You can have a First Amendment that's perfectly enforced and a press that's functionally constrained to the point of irrelevance. Those two things can coexist. The core provisions would require platforms to disclose moderation criteria, report aggregate data on enforcement actions, and provide meaningful appeal processes. I think it has to be all of the above, but with a shift in emphasis. For decades, press freedom advocacy has been primarily a legal project, defending the First Amendment, fighting prior restraint, pushing back against libel suits.
For listeners who aren't journalists and aren't in a position to lobby Congress, what can you actually do? Subscribe directly to independent outlets, not through Apple News or Google News or whatever aggregator is convenient. The advocacy has to migrate too. Every one of those choices rebuilds the direct relationship between publisher and audience that the platform era systematically dismantled.
You can't sue a hedge fund for understaffing a newsroom. Every time you read an article inside a platform's app instead of on the publisher's site, you're giving the platform data about your reading habits and giving the publisher nothing but a fractional cent of ad revenue, if that. You can change the conversation so that when people talk about threats to press freedom, they're not only picturing journalists in jail.
When you share a direct link instead of a platform embed, you're routing around the algorithmic filter. The person who clicks your link sees the article as the publisher intended, not as the platform's recommendation engine decided to present it.
Those actions can help, but they don't solve the deeper question, the one that keeps me up at night.
If the purest form of press freedom is the right to publish without permission, and we now live in a world where permission is granted by algorithms and terms of service agreements, what does press freedom even mean right now?
A journalist deciding that a story isn't worth the personal cost. None of it triggers the alarm bells that explicit censorship would trigger. But the cumulative effect is a press that's less capable of doing its job than it was a decade ago. It was never designed to handle a situation where the distribution infrastructure is privately owned, globally concentrated, and governed by machine learning models that make millions of content decisions per second without human review.
They don't share goals, but the combined effect of their actions is a press environment that's substantially less free in practice than it is in theory. If a large language model can ingest a newspaper's entire archive, then generate articles that paraphrase or restructure that reporting in seconds, does the original publisher still have a press freedom claim? The New York Times versus OpenAI trial is scheduled for early 2027, and the outcome will define whether the economic model of journalism can survive the training data era.
The Times is arguing that training on their content without compensation is copyright infringement. OpenAI is arguing fair use, but the press freedom dimension is deeper than the copyright question. If an AI can produce journalism-like content at zero marginal cost, using the work of human journalists as raw material, the economic foundation of reporting collapses, not because anyone censored anything, but because the product has been commoditized beyond recognition.
Commoditized journalism is just journalism with better grammar. The form survives, the substance doesn't.
Which is exactly the pattern we've been tracing through every mechanism. The pure form of press freedom, the right to publish without prior restraint, remains legally intact. A carnivorous plant used as medicine.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The First Amendment is necessary, but it's not sufficient. You need printing presses, distribution networks, revenue models, and audiences. The legal right is the foundation, but the other pieces have to be there too. Or the right is just words on paper.
Starr's point is exactly right, and it's the thread that connects everything we've discussed. The framers gave us the legal architecture. But the economic and technological architecture that's always been contested, always been shifting, and always required active maintenance. What we've been describing isn't a sudden collapse. It's what happens when the maintenance stops.
Press freedom isn't just about the absence of government censorship. It's about the presence of structural independence. And that independence is harder to maintain than ever. Not because anyone passed a law against it, but because a thousand small decisions, market shifts, and algorithmic tweaks have steadily narrowed the space where independent journalism can survive.
The question we're left with is whether the constitutional guarantee can be updated for a world where the censor isn't a government official with a stamp, but a terms of service agreement, a litigation budget, or a machine learning model. The framers gave us the principle. Keeping it alive in practice is our job.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1880s, a British surveyor in what is now South Sudan accidentally mapped an entire region with a 10-kilometer longitudinal offset because his theodolite had a tiny air bubble trapped in the leveling vial. The resulting maps were used for colonial boundary negotiations, and the error wasn't discovered until 1952, by which time several villages had been taxed by the wrong government for nearly 70 years.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. And if you got something out of this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps independent productions like ours reach new ears. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.